Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Elliot Bazzano. For every program, we choose a new and exciting book and chat with the author. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Isra Yazigiolo, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at St. Joseph's University, about her exciting new book, Understanding Quranic Miracle Stories in the Modern Age, published by Pennsylvania State University Press in 2013. In Understanding Quranic Miracle Stories in the Modern Age, Professor Yazigiolo draws connections between an array of scholars from different time periods and cultures in order to make sense of miracles and miracle stories in the Quran. What are miracles? Why do they occur in stories? And how does the Quran define this complicated concept in particular ways? To address these questions and others, Professor Yazigiolo gives particular attention to Ghazali, Ibn Rushd, David Hume, Charles Peirce, and Said Nursi, which makes for a rich and multi-layered investigation into the limits and possibilities of science, epistemology, and scriptural hermeneutics. In our discussion, we also talk about Professor Yazigiolo's intellectual background as a biologist in secular Turkey turned scholar of religion, and how her own social context has influenced and challenged her scholarly pursuits. Yazigiolo's compelling and well-researched monograph will likely interest not only scholars of the Quran, but also philosophers as well as natural scientists. I hope you enjoy the interview, and without further ado, here's my conversation with Professor Isra Yazigiolo. Good morning, Isra. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And we look forward to hearing about your book, but before we talk about that, could you tell us a little bit about your educational background and how you got interested in Islamic studies, and specifically how you got interested in miracles in the Quran?
Sure. In terms of my education, I come from a medical science background. I was 3 years into medical school before I switched to study religion. And my interest in religion came a bit before my medical school. Back in high school, I was very fortunate to have a wonderful science professor, dear Yamina Murmur. She had a PhD in theoretical physics, and she was also very learned about Islamic theology. So she got me interested in the relation between science and religion. I found it fascinating to think through life's big questions with her. And when I started the university, I was also studying with her and her husband, who is an Islamic scholar as well in Quranic studies. We were studying then subjects in Islamic theology, Quranic interpretation, philosophy of science. And they were also the ones who introduced me to Said Nursi. I did, even though I'm from Turkey and Said Nursi has lived there and wrote there, I didn't know much about him. And he's a great theologian of 20th century. So they also introduced me to his works. So you can imagine me, you know, being very fascinated about these theological texts and then connection between science and religion. And I'm going to medical school doing physiology, biochemistry, and just enjoying, even though I did dread becoming a medical doctor. That was the side note. But so this is going on. And then there's a turning point that happens when I was in my third year in medical school that made me feel that I need to switch full-time religious studies, that I want to study and talk about religion full time. And that was a very sad event, actually. There was in 1998, the fall of 1998, in Turkey, there was this official ban on headscarves. So if you're a woman who is practicing and practicing the wearing the scarf, you know, believing that it's a Muslim obligation, then that meant you couldn't enter the campus. So you literally had policemen show up by my third year. They're like, you cannot go in with that thing on your head, and so on. So that was a hard time. And at the same time, there was these moments where they would take us when this band came finally to our university. It was a public university, but this band, the government band, went everywhere. Private and public everywhere. So you couldn't do it in a private college either. So our dean scheduled meetings with her, and the other professors and the students who wear the headscarf. These were sessions in which they kind of announced the ban to us and also try to justify it and say that, you know, be rational, be reasonable, take it off, you know, don't be silly and so on. And those encounters were a turning point for me because, you know, you have your anatomy professor, you know, meeting you. We also have had separate meetings where she would be looking at, you know, like, it has been reported to me that you took your exam with your headscarf on and you refused to take it off. Now, let's talk about this honor violation. And she would go on talk about how I have to pick between science or religion, and religion is backwards, and we're moderns, and, you know, get over superstition. And I would be like, you know, I became more religious through your anatomy class. The way I looked at it, the more I learned about human body, things made more sense to me spiritually. And she just was looking, and I couldn't believe that somebody so otherwise sophisticated could just get by with those cliches about religion. And that really made me feel like, you know what, I want to switch to studying religion full time. I want to study and I want to talk about religion and show that actually it's not that easy and it's not fair to live by those cliches, that the situation is much more complex than picking between the two. So when I ended up being kicked out of school, not literally kicked out, but they just told me not to come again. And I kept getting detentions for not removing my headscarf. And finally, it was just, you know, it wasn't going to happen. So I had to leave. And I came to the land of the free, to the U.S. And during that time, when I was looking into programs in the U.S., and I had this strong feeling that I don't want to continue with medical school and switch to studying religion full time, then I met Ibrahim Abu Rabi, may Allah may God bless his soul. He was teaching at the Hartford Seminary at the time, and he encouraged me to go ahead and study with him. So that's where I met Ingrid Mattson as well. So I did my master's in Islamic studies and Christian-Muslim relations at Hartford Seminary, and then I continued on to my doctoral studies at the University of Virginia. And there I did more work on philosophy of religion and Quranic interpretation and some comparative Abrahamic traditional study. So, and that's how I ended up being a full-time religious studies person and then becoming a scholar when I finished it. In terms of my particular interest in miracles, you hit the subject of natural order, natural causality, very much, very quickly, if you're looking at Islamic theology and if you look at philosophical works, the idea of how do you make sense of the world around us really comes through pretty quickly. And the miracle story is very interesting way of thinking about nature and natural law and order around us. And my particular incentive came when I was in a very casual conversation with my relatives, and one of my aunts, she was talking about, we were talking about virgin birth, it just a topic that came up, and she said, you know, I believe in this miracle story in the Quran, but you know, if a woman came to me now and she said, I'm pregnant but I'm virgin, I wouldn't be able to believe her, to be honest. So that struck me and they stayed with me. I was like, what is she trying to say? Initially, I thought that's ridiculous. Nobody who believes in the story would believe such a woman in this day and age anyway. But that was her way of asking the question, what do these miracle stories mean? Why are they in the Quran? What do we make of them? It's not just about simply whether we believe in them or not. people, we tend to think there's this two camps. Some people believe in that these miracles can happen, other people who don't, and that's it. Whereas here's somebody asking in her commonsensical way, saying, okay, I believe in it. Okay, it can happen. All right, fine, I got it. Or I personally believe in this. Okay, fine. But what do I do with this? Okay, this happened once in the entire human history, one time, a virgin conceived. Okay, so what do I do with this? Where does that take me? And that really was an opening to me to think more clearly about, I wanted to look at miracle stories and see what they could really mean. Not just in modern age, but I happen to be in this age. But in general, like why these miracle stories are there in the Quran? And then it enabled me to talk about and discover how fidelity to the text, sacred text, and critical thinking are much more intertwined than we assume usually.
Yeah, and I appreciate the way that you framed it, especially given your background, that you had this literal but also symbolic moment where you were at least allegedly supposed to make a choice between religion and science. And like you're saying, obviously it's much less black and white than this, but a lot of people see it that way. So I appreciate you framing things like that. So as we move into talking about the book, you mentioned the story about your aunt as somebody who sort of straddles this in-between space in terms of she's not exactly sure what to do with the story, but she believes it, but maybe it only happened once. So when your average reader picks up the book, do you think, what do you think the average reader is going to think about miracles as they begin reading your text?
I think there will be a range of different types of readers, but a common type could be picking up the book and saying, okay, so is she going to show us that can miracles happen or not? Do they happen or not? And then hopefully as they go in, and read more, that they'll see that the whole question is much more complicated than that and much richer than that. So, and then for some other readers, it might be even a non-issue. You know, why are we talking about miracles in this day and age? You know, this is the age of technology. We're doing so many incredible stuff. Who would even talk about outdated miracle stories? So there's this, a scholar calls this as the academic sneer factor involved in discussing miracles.
Yeah.
That could be there too. And I think it's, the book, I'm hoping that the book is welcoming all kinds of different starting points, because throughout the book, whatever figure I'm looking at, whether it's Hume or Peirce or Ghazali or Nursi, I try to retrieve, maybe retrieve is not the best word, but to get the best I can get out of each author. My task is not there to say, oh, this is right, this is wrong. Why is to say, like, why would an author insist on this particular point so much? What is the insight here? So I feel like I'm hoping that the book is welcoming to all kinds of starting points and all kinds of backgrounds, because it's really trying to delve into a rich subject and bring as much insight as possible without really banning one way of thinking.
Sure, and I think that clearly comes across given the breadth of scholars and time periods that you've looked at. I absolutely agree that this book will speak to a large audience. And so you mentioned that this question, do miracles happen or not, like it's more complicated than that. So what would you say is the main objective for your book, or is there a main central question that you are trying to answer?
Yeah, so in terms of the objectives of the book, I think I want to do at least two things. One is to encourage us all to rethink what we take for granted, because we have this commonsensical view vis-a-vis the world and the text as well, sacred text as well. And to some extent, that's justified. We need some common sense to go through life, and we need to take certain things for granted to be able to plan our lives and so on. But when it becomes ossified, it hurts us. because it deprives us from a much richer of looking at the world and being in the world. So one of the things that this book wants to do is to encourage us to rethink what we take for granted. And at the center of it is natural order. We live in a world with incredible order, a lot of order. There are exceptions to order as well, but generally this is a world in which we see a lot of regularity to the extent that we start doing science. We start predicting things on the basis of past patterns. So, and it comes to a point where we start thinking that this is how things have to be. This is a given. And this book is trying to kind of make us rethink. And in general, I think miracle stories are trying to do this. And whether you're looking at the medieval debate between Ibn Rushd or Ghazali or a more modern debate, or looking at Peirce or Said Nursi, in all of that, they are grappling with this fact that we see regularity around us, but can we take it for granted? And the moment we take it for granted, we start thinking that they are just ordinary in the just cheap sense of the word, you know, and there's nothing ordinary about a seed bursting into life or a wound healing or an embryo growing into a full baby or a water falling down from the sky or something evaporating. These are extraordinary events. Yes, they happen regularly. Yes, we can predict them. Yes, we can even calculate the formula of the speed of X, Y, Z, but that doesn't make them a given. They are still things that don't have to happen in any shape or form, but they do happen regularly. And to take that as something to think about, as a sign, as a gift, even instead of taking it for granted. That's one of the things that this book wants to do. And then the second one is this book wants to illustrate how sacred texts, and in this particular case, the Quran, can be read in different ways. And there, in what appears to be very simple and strange in one level is actually very profound in another way. So like miracle stories, we look at them and it's like, okay, some people might look at it and it's like, okay, this is just an old superstitious story. Or someone else can say, well, it must have happened if the text says so, but I don't know what to do with it. It doesn't make any change in my life. And then somebody like Ghazali comes along and he's like, if this miracle story can be true, if there is such a miracle story in this text, what does that say about natural order? If this natural order can be interrupted even for once, that means it's not logically necessary. That means it's contingent. Really? How is that so? And that opens up a whole horizon for him to rethink the medieval legacy that he was working with. And then he's credited for this breakthrough. He's, Aristotelian thought had a lot of good in it, but then he had this limitation that whatever continuously happened over and over, they said this is not rationally necessary, which is funny to us, in the modern age, but that's how they thought. And many people still think that way. But the breakthrough comes to realize that, even if it happens like that over and over in your empirical level, in your experience, doesn't mean it has to be that way. And that enables you to rethink how you think about possibilities and then also the existential level of this. So I want to show in this book that something that may look very strange at, superficially may be actually very profound and very enriching in the sacred text. And to put the text into its existential context, if you will. I mean, I don't use this particular word actually in the book, but if I were to have addition, I would add it. I call it pragmatic reading in the book. But what I really mean is to put the text into its existential context. This is a text, in this case, the Quran, is a text that claims to be the word of somebody who runs the world, who sustains heavens and the earth, and including human beings. Now, it's a separate question whether somebody believes in that claim or not. But when we're looking at the text, we cannot pretend that it doesn't claim that. It does claim that. So if it comes that, then in addition to putting the text into its linguistic and historical context, we need to allow the text to exist in that existential context where it says, I am here to crack the code to your existence. So if the text is saying this and then going ahead and talking about miracle stories, then with that attitude, it was like, what could it be enriching for my existence about these stories, these miracle stories? And especially given that this text at other places says you don't need miracles to believe. So why is this text telling me all these miracle stories? And so the moment we ask that question, what difference does the text make or can it make in a reader's life? That is extremely powerful. And then things that may not have come up otherwise come up.
Yeah. And so in terms of words that you do use in the text, miracle is obviously one of those things. And so when you're using the word miracle in English, what do you have in mind? And what kind of correspondence is there in the Quran for this concept? And also, is there a term that the Quran itself uses to describe these miracle stories?
Very good. That's a really good question because, as you know, I never actually defined miracle in English in the text because I wanted to use it in just the most basic sense. And somebody can take miracle as something extraordinary. That's how we tend to use it in English. Or something that goes beyond the capacity of natural factors, that it calls for an agency of something beyond. And whatever way you take it, the bottom line here is that the Quran itself never uses a particular term that would literally mean miracle. Ma'ajizah is typically considered to be the equivalent of miracle in Arabic. And it literally means something that which overwhelms and overpowers. And in traditional Islamic theology, this came to mean that something that which God a prophet overwhelms his opponents. So the opponents say, you're not a real prophet, you're just making this up. And then the prophet, by God's will, shows a miracle that is something which overwhelms them. And they say, oh, whoa, can you do that? We can't do that. And we don't think anything naturally can happen like that. So there must be somebody behind you, somebody transcendent who sends you. The Quran itself doesn't have a word for it. And that's really exciting too. It refers to miracles as a sign. And that is the same term used for natural events in the Quran. Rain is a sign too. A flower is a road sign too. So that's the exciting point. And that's where this medieval thinkers and interpreters look at, especially I see that in Ghazali, more strongly in Nursi. And Nursi enables me to kind of come and see that more clearly in Ghazali's work. But that's definitely a key moment in the Quran. The same word is used for what we would call as extraordinary, as well as for the ordinary stuff.
Right. And I think It's really important that you point that out because it demonstrates really clearly how a native English speaker could bring baggage to the text that isn't really reflected in the text. And so, like you're talking about not taking stuff for granted, I think even the basic terminology demonstrates that so well. So now, talking about the figures that you explore, there's five figures. You look at Ghazali, Ibn Rushd, Hume, Pierce, and Nursi from the more modern period. So do you want to say something about Ghazali and Ibn Rushd, because these are the pre-modern Muslim scholars that you look at, in terms of how they contributed to this discussion about what miracles mean, and also how Ghazali and Ibn Rushd see things differently?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So Ghazali lives almost a century before Ibn Rushd. And he is looking at miracle stories, taking the text very seriously. I think Ibn Rushd also takes the Quran very seriously, but Ghazali takes it to a deeper level because he, like everybody else, he would find these miracle stories unusual, right? I mean, things are happening that you yourself never saw before and probably never ever see again in your lifetime. So the text is talking about these, and then there is the assumption that, well, they had their own medieval science. So they were discovering patterns in the world. And there was this tendency to take things as they are. This is how it is. Fire burns. It has to burn. And then you read the Marcos story. It says Abraham didn't burn. So what do you do with that? And Ghazali really took that tension seriously. And really, I think one difference between Ghazali and Ibn Rushd, as I see from outside, is that Ghazali was willing to kind of live with that unease for a while. And then he puts forth a very, very strong philosophical argument about how miracles can happen, even though they don't happen usually. They can, logically. And then it's so interesting because he spends really good energy in doing that, and it's very convincing and brilliant philosophical critique there. And he shows that, yes, miracles can happen logically, okay? But then he doesn't consider miracles or miracle stories as essential for formation of faith. You don't believe because of miracle stories. You believe because the message of the prophet makes sense to you in a very deep way. Rationally, as well as spiritually, it does make sense to you. It fits with you. That's why you believe. Especially in his later works, he says this. And then we're left with the question, so if you're not going to consider miracles as essential to formation of faith, so why are you spending so much time trying to prove that they can occur? What's at stake for you there? And I had to do a little bit of interpretation there, but I do demonstrate that it's very fair to Ghazali to say that he's insisting on their possibility because of the way in which it changes the way we see nature. You can't take nature as granted. You can't say fire has to burn. No, it doesn't have to burn. There's nothing logical about it, but it does burn. It means there must be some choice behind it, that somebody's making a choice for it to burn. Because if there's a regularity that happens over and over again, which doesn't have to happen logically, that means there's somebody behind the scenes who is making a choice, a wise choice, to uphold that pattern. So to him, regularity brings you to God, because there must be someone behind the scenes. And it also allows you to trust that being who is sustaining the world in this particular way has wisdom. So he's not going to randomly change the order, or he's not going to do anything to hurt you. But he can change the order, and you should not idolize the order as if it's working on its own. So that's Ghazali's, what Ghazali is doing with miracle stories. He reads them as stories of interruption that enables us to appreciate what is not interrupted. So if the fire doesn't have to burn, each time it burns, when you make your tea, each time you make your tea on fire, you appreciate that there is this fire that gives warmth through which you are able to boil your tea. It didn't have to be that way. Every second that fire has to, it has to be a channel of that warmth. It can't burn on its own. So for Ghazali, that's the breakthrough, in addition to the logical breakthrough that he introduced to medieval epistemology. That really forms the backbone of modern epistemology, as I alluded earlier. What Ibn Rushd is doing, he's coming to the Quran, and he's fascinated by the passages in the Quran that encourage people to think about nature, to reflect, meditate on nature, and use their reason. So he is also coming to the Quran in a way. He's looking at it, and then he's also confirming it in his experience, that he's like, yeah, things work, and there is regularity in the world, and I can think. So he's very excited about those passages. And he is also very excited about Aristotelian philosophy. So he thinks there is this incredible harmony between the two. Okay. So, but when it comes to miracle stories, that miracle stories are hard to account for within a rigid Aristotelian framework, because in Aristotelian framework, empirical truth or empirical data, empirical reality, and logical reality are merged. There is no distinction between empirical stuff and logical stuff as we do today. Everybody does it now. We do it in modern age. They were merged in Aristotelian era, Aristotelian context. So he wants to stick to that. When Ghazali questions that, when Ghazali says things don't have to happen in a particular way, Ibn Rushd freaks out. to put it, you know, in that crude terms, because he thinks Ghazal, if we accept Mirko's stories and literally as they are, then we are rejecting science, and he's very worried about that, and rightly so. Rightly so, because and I don't ultimately agree with Ibn Rushd, but he's very insightful because he teaches us what miracle stories cannot mean. He says, no, we can't read these stories in a way that would deny validity to science. Okay, but Ghazal is not doing that. He's just saying, you go ahead, do your science, just don't pretend that you what these patterns that you discover have to be that way, and don't pretend that you thereby push God to the very beginning of the chain and not in every moment. So they differ in these ways, and in the way they approach the Quran also they differ. Ghazali, to me, he is more receptive to the text, even if it bothers him initially. He tries to work around it, and he tries to see what it can teach him. And Ibn Rushd is more on the defensive in some level, and he says, okay, this text is here. As a philosopher, I can't accept the literal sense. I can't accept that natural order can be interrupted at any moment, because for him it's a logical truth, not just an empirical reality. So he says, okay, I will allow certain readers to take it at its face value. So he divides the interpreters into categories. So some commonsensical people, if they can believe in that story, go ahead, let them believe. But in the higher level, you're not supposed to believe it, that this can be real. He doesn't, to be honest with him, to be fair to Ibn Rushd, he doesn't say this way explicitly, but the way he discusses the whole thing and disagrees so strongly with Ghazali takes us there.
Yeah, and I think this is a helpful thought experiment for other contexts too, because just the whole idea of questioning the epistemology of science, it's a very taboo thing to do. Mm-hmm. But in part, right, things are taboo because they're taboo. And so, you know, being able to see, rewind the clock 800 years and see Ghazali asking these questions is, mm-hmm. I think, refreshing in a really interesting way. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of context that mm-hmm. I think connect in the modern world. Mm-hmm. So after you talk about Ghazali and Ibn Rushd, you talk about, you shift gears a little bit and you look at Hume and Peirce. So could you say a little bit about what they add to the conversation and also why you chose to look at them? I think, and correct me if you disagree, but I think a lot of readers will see Ghazali, Ibn Rushd. These are two very big names in Islamic intellectual history. So I won't be surprised when they add to this conversation. And then you bring in different kinds of thinkers. So what was your strategy there, and what kinds of contributions do they make to this discussion?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we turn to Hume and Peirce in the next two chapters, and they are. I look at them in the book because they show us how these questions that were brought up about through the miracle stories are shared questions. They can be asked in different forms, in different contexts. So Hume and Peirce, they definitely did not read the Quran, to the best of my knowledge, but they asked similar questions about natural order and possibility of its interruption. And also, I picked Hume and Peirce because Hume is considered to be somewhat a big turning point in Western thought, in the sense that he really challenged some of the assumptions of rationalism and really shook them to the core, that after Hume, you couldn't just take them for granted like that. It wouldn't be possible. So he, and it's not, as I say in the book, it's not original to him. When he questioned the rationalist assumptions, and he criticized induction method as not yielding certainty. This is not unique to him. It was said before by some of the people in the European milieu, and also, you know, 5 centuries ago by Ghazali. So it's not original to him. But what is original to Hume is that he's able to articulate these in a very accessible language that could not be ignored anymore. So, for instance, this connection between cause and effect, a natural cause and a natural effect, you know, people thought, you know, this is the cause and it makes the effect. And that's logical. And Hume comes along and he does what Ghazali did in his medieval context. He brings this breakthrough from that way of thinking and saying, listen, there's nothing logical about fire burning. There's nothing logical about when you leave a stone unsupported that it will fall downward instead of upward. There's nothing logical about it. It's just that it happened over and over again, and you said, well, it has to happen. It doesn't have to happen. And that becomes almost like a crisis in a way, because if there's nothing logical about it, there's no certainty, certain ground on which we can build our expectations for the future. Because if the ball doesn't have to fall, even if you see it 1,000 times falling, it doesn't mean it has to fall 1,001th time. You know, 1,001st time. So, and that's a big, big crisis. He brings the kind of wound open. It's there, but he brings it to the open, and then he doesn't quite give us a way out of it. But at least he puts it on the table. And after Hume, you can't just assume that yes, we prove stuff, and this is how things are. You can't take things for granted. And Kant deals with this question. Much of what he was doing was in response to Hume, that, you know, how am I going to, you know, talk about certainty in response to this? So Hume is important that way, and he's also famous for his critique of miracles. So I take Hume to be almost like a resurrected Ghazali-Ibn Rushd hybrid, because like Ghazali, he questions this idea that natural causality is logical and cannot be interrupted. And like Ibn Rushd, he turns around and says miracles can't happen. And it's a contradiction for him, but at the same time, I see it as highlighting two crucial moments. One, that we can't be naive about natural order anymore, and we can't make these grand claims about it has to happen that way. At the same time, we have something at stake about protecting common sense and being able to live in a world where we can expect things to happen in a particular way. So Ibn Rushd does a good job, Hume does a good job of bringing forth that two dimensions, even though it's kind of contradictory for him, but it works for our purposes. And I picked Peirce because he is a first-rate philosopher who is also a first-rate scientist at the same time. So he has been in the scientific field. He was a chemist, and he worked as a chemist for over a decade. And then he's this brilliant mind who also thought through the implications of philosophy of science and so on. So he comes along, and he really gives us some important keys about how to both affirm our understanding of nature in a way that doesn't disrupt our trust in common sense and expecting things to happen in a certain way. At the same time, he gives us a way of anchoring them in a bigger, in a metaphysical, he wasn't a metaphysicist, but he does anchor it in what he calls the scientific metaphysics, which means he allows or he builds a certain concepts that allows him to talk about the possibility of science in a world that's not absolute. It's a contingent world. I don't know if that's making
certainly. And so this is a half joke, but I have to ask it anyway. So when Hume was resurrected as an incarnate, or when Ghazali and Ibn Rushd were resurrected into Hume, was that a real miracle or and anyways, you don't have to answer that. That was just a bad joke. So Hume and Peirce, so they're bringing this later idea that Ghazali had already talked about earlier, but they have a different context, and they're adding things to it and have a different educational background, which affects things. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, you talk about Nursi, and he's his own sort of character. So could you tell us a little bit about who Nursi is, and then how he relates to these other thinkers that you had already been looking at?
Yeah. So Sayyid Nursi was a great theologian and Quranic interpreter who lived at the end of 19th century till mid 20th century. He died in 1960. He had a long life. And he's very interesting and unfortunately very, very understudied. What he does is that he's one of those minds who is aware of the modern situation or contemporary situation. He realizes that some of the things that people didn't ask before are asked now, and some of the things that are put forth are actually they need to be questioned further. So one of the things is this is a time in which science is a big thing. I know science is improving, technology is working wonders, and people are just fascinated by it to the extent that they start making these grand claims about how they know everything about the world, and then they prove things, and then you don't actually need a transcendent in the picture anymore. And this is very similar to what Peirce went through. I mean, similar time frame. And Peirce actually got a lot of heat for insisting that the patterns we discover in the world are not absolute. And that's what eventually turns out to be for miracles for Peirce, because miracles are those statements articulations showing that there is regularity in the world, it's real, but it's not absolute. And there's always exceptions to these natural laws that we discover. It's a more fluid world than some scientists have us believe. And that era, there was a lot of rigidity about natural law. People felt like, you know, we found the laws, but there's a law for everything, even though we didn't find it. There's regularities to the extent that there's no free will. Everybody's product of their, you know, environment and genes, this, that. And this was this mechanistic worldview. And when he said, no, but there's nothing in our empirical data that shows this. This is not accurate, because we do find patterns, but we also find exceptions in patterns. When he said this...
Can I ask you about that, Esra? So what would be some examples of from science where we've assumed that there's a pattern and then we find that there's an exception to the pattern?
Everything. Think of gravity. Okay, so we have a formula for gravity that we can calculate if you give me the height from which you drop the stone and its surface area, whatever. I can calculate to you how fast it will fall down and so on and so forth, right? So we do have a pattern. But then this is, if you go out in the world and if a leaf is falling, you can't give me ever the exact way it will fall and exact time frame it will fall in. You can give me a range. But you can't, because there is lots of diversity in the world. So we do minimize these other things and try to have a basic figure so we can construct buildings and so on and so forth. But we actually really don't know exactly how a leaf falls down. I mean, not how, but we can't really give you a precise calculation of how this particular leaf will fall down.
Sure.
Just can't. And everything is like that. You know, temperature, boiling, everything. I can tell you around this temperature, it will start evaporating water, but I can't tell you exactly when, because it's always a range.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So there are patterns, definitely. We don't live in a chaotic world, but it's also a world of diversity, spontaneity, right? If somebody says, it's not my job to talk about that, I'm a scientist, I'm looking at just the patterns, fine. But if that becomes a worldview, then it's misleading, right? So a scientist can say, a psychiatrist, a psychologist can go in and say, you know what, I'm interested in patterns. So I'm going to bracket free will. I really am interested in what kind of families produce what kind of children, if there is domestic violence in the house, what percentage of the kids become violent when they grow up. I'm just interested in looking at environmental factors and genetic factors, and I'm going to bracket free will. Fine, she can do that. But we cannot come around at the end and forget that there is no free will, because we can't take it into account in science. Okay, you can't take it into account for your purposes. That doesn't mean this is not a world in which free will is real, right? So this happens all the time, this kind of mixing, confusing the registers.
Yeah, So I thought it would be helpful for our listeners to exactly what you said. There's so many examples. It's not just one thing. Mm. It comes back to this question, right, of epistemology and why we assume we know what we know. Mm. And so returning to Nursi, so how else does he contribute to the discussion about miracles in the Quran?
An interpreter of the Quran. Okay, he is a Quranic theologian. And one of the things that makes him so important is that he reads the Quran within its existential context and always with an idea that what is it telling to the reader? How does it change the way the reader would see the world? So he takes similarly miracle stories in a very, very profound way. And he would bring it in ways that you're reading the text and you're like, whoa, how did he make that connection? So he would talk about signs of God in nature. So natural stuff, nothing extraordinary, but it's extraordinary in the sense that the things that are happening cannot be accounted for by the natural causes we associated them with.
Right.
For instance, let's say a baby is growing. What are causes going inside into that? I know there's DNA, there is the mother eats a lot of, you know, salad, this, that, hormones, and what comes out is this incredibly complex being, very well organized, and throughout the process of pregnancy, this baby is cared for in a very special way, and there's the compassion is there, there's knowledge there. Whatever is making this baby knows there's sunshine outside. So her eyes get, you know, figured according to the sunshine outside. Whatever is making this baby knows that there's something to eat outside. So her stomach and enzymes are configured accordingly. And plus there's consciousness and that plus she has emotions and so on. So what goes in, these DNA is a recipe. Okay, recipe goes in and these different chemicals go in and this comes out. So Nursi says, you know what? What goes in and what comes out, there is an incredible gap between the two. Because the things that go in, they don't know how to plan. They don't know they don't have comprehensive knowledge. And they don't certainly don't have the mercy to care about this thing's well-being, nor the creativity. And some of the things that go in, most of them are dead. DNA is not alive. But then what comes out is filled with life. He says there is this gap between the two. And in that gap, qualities of God, Al-Asma al-Husna, come out. That there must be someone wise behind the scenes, someone incredibly creative and life-giver behind the scenes who is taking these natural causes and, you know, creating this result. So he's... And as he's talking about this, and this is nothing necessarily extraordinary in the Islamic thought. This is, you know, a typical mainstream Sunni theology put in modern terms. And it's the key Quranic piece because the Quran keeps talking about how the world is designed. That gap between what goes in and what comes out is the sign that there must be somebody else in the scene who's acting, who's creating. So he's bringing in the Quran very clearly here, and then uses the term miracle here. And that's the fascinating use of the term miracle. He says, this event is a miracle. Not in the sense that it's extraordinary, it doesn't happen. It happens all the time. But what the result exceeds the capacity of the natural causes that we associated them with. We think in superficial level, this made that. But then if you think about it, this can't make that. But it happens, yeah. It happens all the time, but still it can't make that. So there must be somebody behind the scenes, and this is a miracle. So he says, he uses term miracles for everyday stuff, which is very Quranic because the same term for miracle in the Quran is the same term for natural stuff in the Quran. Sign, ayah. So he brings that into the picture. And that's very powerful, the way he does it. And then he says, when you see a plant digging its roots through the hard rock and soil. That's incredible. Yes, it happens. And we know how to describe it. There's an enzyme that comes out and that soil is pierced through and that those very weak roots, they reach out to the water below. It happens all the time, but this is amazing because what goes in is this fluid. And what comes out, this incredible result, that this thing is wisely able to detect and reach the water, despite the hard rock. So he says, this is Moses' staff hitting the water in the Quran. This event is reciting this miracle story to you. So that's another incredible thing in Nursi's thought, that he keeps talking about the world speaking, talking about God. So, and then he does it in a very sophisticated way that takes into all the scientific concerns and scientific misunderstandings, that people misunderstand science. So he takes that in as well and makes connections to Ibn Rushd's concerns about science, to Ghazali's concern about existential connection, to Peirce. So in that way, he really becomes a nice way of articulating some of the major insights about natural order and the way we exist in that order and the way we respond to that, not as taking it for granted, but with gratitude. That really comes all together in Nursi's work.
Yeah, and I think another one of the helpful things insightful, innovative things you do in the book is you bring together all these voices that might not necessarily be paired together, but you show how they're addressing similar questions in different contexts. And so it just raises the idea that these questions about what to do with miracles and how to think about epistemology, these are human questions that people answer in different times and places, and the Quran is also interested in these questions. So coming back to this question about this false binary between religion and science, what do you think about this binary between literal and metaphorical readings of the Quran? I know you've been talking about this throughout, and you delve into it in the book. But if you could have some final thoughts about how readers and our listeners might think about these seemingly binary ways of approaching the Quran through the literal or the metaphorical.
Yeah. So when we put the text in its existential context and really take seriously its main claims about what it wants to do to us, you know, it's saying, the text is saying, I'm here from your creator and I want to inform and enlighten the way you see the world, you exist in the world. Now, if we take that seriously, then and really tune into the text, then we see that there is no tension between literal and metaphorical. And we don't have to choose between the two necessarily. So in the case of, for instance, miracle stories, when Nursi reads Moses' staff and then sees it happening in everyday life, in nature, now he's not trying to pick between the two. He's not trying to say, well, I can't take it literally, but I can take it in metaphorical sense in nature. No, the very literal sense leads to the metaphorical in a way. Because when you take it seriously that this could happen to Moses, that what I take as granted could be interrupted and is actually contingent, it can be the other way around, then you start seeing the world differently, even the regularity differently. To give an example, let's say, Elliot, you take roses to your wife every Monday night, okay? Every single Monday night. It has been a couple of years. You do it all the time. So one Monday night, you come in, and you don't have roses.
Uh-oh.
You got something else, okay?
Yeah.
You got chocolate. Or you didn't get anything, let's say, just that Monday. That interruption is important in itself, okay? At the same time, that interruption enables your wife to think about all those moments where you did actually bring roses on Monday night.
Right.
So that interruption brings her back to the uninterrupted and make her appreciate uninterrupted, uninterrupted events. So similarly, like when you read a miracle story like Virgin Birth, It perplexes us, it surprises us, it shocks us, right? It's an interruption. You need two parents, and here you go. There's only one parent, one human, you know, one parent. So how is that going to work out? So that interruption enables the reader to come back and rethink the pregnancies that he considered as normal.
Right.
So then that brings you to the understanding that there was nothing logical about Elliot bringing roses Monday nights. He didn't have to. There's no logical link between it being Monday and you receiving roses from your husband, even if it happened for centuries. There's no logical link. So then that interruption enables you to have a different look at the way the regular stuff happen. So similarly, in this case, then some people say, well, what do? Do we take it in a way that it doesn't change the way we think about order? Let's take it metaphorically so it doesn't change the way we think about natural order. That doesn't work. Let's take it literally. What does that mean? Even if you take it literally, okay, you take it literally, things can happen, exceptions can happen. But if it doesn't change the way you look at the world, it's also useless. So the choice is not between literal and metaphorical necessarily. The choice is really to allow the text to offer a way of looking at the world that's different from what we could have found on our own, and that really changes the way we see the world. And that's the key for me, I think.
Right. And we unfortunately haven't had time to talk about this, but one of the really interesting parts of the book that stuck out at me was how interpreters of the Quran were arguing that the non-literal readings could be better readings sometimes, not because the literal reading is impossible, but like you were saying, because the non-literal reading is like less mysterious and has some kind of relevance on someone's life.
Exactly.
And yeah, I found that that's striking. So we've taken up a bit of your time. So before we conclude, could I just ask maybe what might be an obvious question, but I'm sure you've thought about it a lot. So what's your favorite miracle story in the Quran? And I use the term favorite as you'd like to interpret it. It's the most perplexing, the most interesting, the thing that people have struggled with the most. So however you want to interpret that, I'd be curious on your thoughts.
I actually don't have a particular favorite miracle story. I think each miracle story is in itself an interruption in a different way, and each has its unique aspect to it. So I don't have a particular miracle story. I do know Staff of Moses, Ghazali uses it as almost like a symbolic way of talking about it. Is a shorthand to talk about miracles. So that is also mentioned a lot repeatedly in the Quran.
Right.
But I don't have a particular favorite episode in the Quran. Virgin birth is interesting, and that's how I started out the book, because one could say, this is ridiculous, it can't happen. Why do we even read this kind of stuff in this day and age? I can hear somebody saying that. At the same time, this is the age in which we literally have women conceiving with outside of conventional intercourse. So this, we have this reproductive technology that things are happening in the ways that didn't ever happen before. So, and actually this could apply to other miracle stories as well. That's why they're still so relevant, because the things that we think are normal now, 2 centuries ago, if you told it to somebody, they would think you're mad.
Right.
Like if I told somebody that I'm going to talk to somebody who is thousands of miles away from me, they would be saying, Isra, you lost it. It's not possible, right? But it's happening. And then the question of interpretation comes, like how do you interpret this? And instead of taking it for granted or bragging about how smart we are, we need to come back and what kind of world that we can detect an incredible order, and then we can actually utilize that order to do things new. And what is behind this? Who is behind this? And then that takes us to think more, a bit more about how we perceive the world around us.
Yeah, and I think, just to emphasize again, I think this book will interest a lot of different people because of the different angles that it looks at things, but also because of these questions that relate to so many things besides just the figures that you look at or just the Quran. But I think the way that you started things off by talking about this moment in your medical school career and then your shift to interest in religious studies, I think that's very reflective in a lot of ways of the different angles you take to the book and the types of questions you ask. So I really appreciate that. So before we conclude, Isra, could you tell us a little bit about what you're currently working on and some future projects, and will they relate to or depart from your monograph on miracles in the Quran?
Sure. So currently I'm working on a translation project. What I am doing is I'm looking at, with a colleague of mine, we're looking at some of the key passages in Sayyid Nursi and translating them into English with annotation. And this is growing out of my work on miracles, and that the way, so Nursi brought together various concerns about interpreting the Quran and living it out in the world by allowing it to inform the way we see nature, the way we see the world, the way we see ourselves in it. I want to offer one almost like a reader on Said Nursi who could that would give access to people to access Nursi's works a bit more and hopefully study more, because he's really understudied. And then beyond that, I'm not sure which direction to take. On one hand, I'm being pulled towards existential context. So I want to look at passages in the Quran where, again, it appears to be like irrelevant or confusing. And then to look at the reception history and see how meaningful they were. I mean, they were understood to be, or they can be. Said Nursi gives a lot of wealth in that aspect, and there are also some favorite classical interpreters that I want to bring in. So I did that a bit with my article on Abraham's attempt at sacrificing his son. And there, again, if you see a passage, it's ridiculous, it seems at first. It's like, what? You should be willing to kill your son when God wants you to do? What a ridiculous text. Child abuse? What is it? And then this is within a tradition where child sacrifice is forbidden. And here is an interesting, perplexing moment. And then if you go through in that article, I unpack, and the ways in which this provocative text has been understood to yield so much insight that would not appear to us in the beginning. And again, by putting the text into existential context. So that's one way I want to go toward. And the other one I'm not sure about is to look at science textbooks, that's the science part, to look at some science textbooks and to see there how what's going on in the textbook is going beyond regular science into fields of metaphysics and theology. And to say, to invite us to rethink some of the ways in which we talk about things in science. We have incredible use for science. At the same time, some of the stuff said in the name of science are actually not scientific. They are philosophical views,
right,
passed under the view of science, you know. So that's another direction I want to look at, like what would it be to have a project of, you know, taking a middle school science textbook and see the ways in which a scientist is making great, contribution to our understanding of the world. And at the same time, he's going beyond just talking about science, but he's actually now putting forth his worldview. And it's important to notice that so that we can more explicitly talk about that and be have more room for agreeing and disagreeing rather than it being insisted under the name of science.
Well, these sound like very exciting projects, Isra, and I look forward to learning about them as a fan of your work and someone who's presented on you with panels. Of course, I'll look forward to learning about these future projects. And finally, thank you so much for joining us today. I think this is a really rich discussion, and I think our listeners will benefit a lot from hearing you unpack your book. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Elliot. This was a pleasure.
That was my conversation with Isra Yazigiolo, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at St. Joseph's University, about her new book, Understanding Quranic Miracle Stories in the Modern Age, published by Pennsylvania State University Press, 2013. Thanks for listening.